Everyone, tonight, if you will open up your New Testaments to James, the fifth chapter, we'll use verses 7 through 11 as our text tonight. Saying about Joshua up here leading, singing, his father and I go back to when in the summers of 78 and 79, I worked in a summer training program. What are you going woe for? And I know it's a long time ago, right? Yeah, you were 5 years old. Yeah, you're young. But I thought about Don being just a freshman in high school, his dad, when I first met him, and the relationship that we developed then, and it has gone on. I didn't foresee at that point that Don himself was going to be a gospel preacher, but that took place fairly quickly in his life. That's what he has done all of his time in serving the Lord. And then I've known Josh and Daniel and Sarah since they were just babies, and it's really interesting to watch that happen in life and see then young men come that you knew and watch them develop and become such fine servants of the Lord. So anyway, that was on my mind. Pardon me for reminiscing. James, the fifth chapter, and beginning at verse 7, the text says, "Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." Winston Churchill was invited back to his preparatory school to make a speech to the students after his long career in politics. Everyone, of course, was ready for a long speech of a man who would probably reminisce about his life to his alma mater. But his speech that he gave on that occasion was probably the shortest one that he ever delivered. He simply got up and said, "Gentlemen, never, 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 never give up." And then he sat down. Well, of course, it made it very memorable because he would usually obviously go much longer than that. But just the words themselves, "never give up," is the text that we are reading here as far as you and I as Christians are thinking about our walk with the Lord. There's no more promise that is comforting to us, more comforting to us than when we are troubled, than the promise of the Lord's return. And so twice in this passage, he speaks of that. What we need to understand is that difficulties are going to come our way. And even if we are accorded a fair measure of peace in our time, still we can let things become too enticing in this place and in this world. Ellen Thompson wrote in Kent Hughes' commentary, he references her, "Life is too comfortable and things too important for us to want to leave this world, making it hard to sing with integrity. On Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land where my possessions lie." We are really blessed in this country, as our brother prayed a minute ago, so blessed that I wonder if we really long to go over there. Because we just have it really good here. And we're able to go and do the things we want to do and enjoy blessings and things that the world at large and away from us simply have no concept of. We don't think of ourselves as being rich, but we are filthy rich compared to most of the world that is in existence, not only now, but in all of time. The word that he uses here about the second coming of the Lord, at verse 7 and 8, he says, "until the coming of the Lord," in the beginning of verse 7, and then at 8 he says, "for the coming of the Lord is at hand," is the Greek word parousia. It means basically to come alongside of. It is very much like the word that translates the Holy Spirit as being comforter in most of the versions we read. But it was a word that is used 15 times, this word, 15 times in the New Testament, and it almost always outside of the New Testament denotes the physical arrival of a ruler or his presence It was used in the papyri of the secular Greek of a royal visit to any city. And so the idea is that God's son, the royal king, is coming again. And because he is coming again, there are certain attitudes that he wants us to have in this world. The first of them references, if you think of the context, you have to back up. Why does he say at verse 7, be patient? And by the way, thinking about that word, patient, and then we'll talk about its context. The Greek word here is makrothumeo, and it has the word macro, as we understand, large. It just describes anything like that. And thumeo means thermos, for instance, in our language, so heat or passion. So it's the ability, the word is saying, to hold our passions in long. And we translate it, in most versions, as long-suffering. Have you ever noticed that your spell checker does not know that word? Every time I type long-suffering in any article or in anything, it comes up and checks it, because it just simply is not a word that's used much outside of us understanding the Bible. Long-tempered may be another way of saying it. It has the idea of endurance in it, of an active thing. I'd like that word better than I like the word patience. And you may hear a lot of times commentators or others reference that, because patience has almost a passive quality to us, that you just kind of resign yourself to it. And if we read this passage that way, that we're just resigning ourselves to something, then that we're going to miss the point, I think, that James and others in the New Testament, when they use makrothumeo, are saying to us. Now the context. If you back up, why verse 7? Why does he say, be long-suffering, hold your passions in, brothers, until the coming of the Lord? Well, if you back up to verses 1 through 6, he's talking about how the rich abuse those who are less fortunate in this world. Notice at verse 4, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields are kept back by fraud by you, and are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached up to the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. Most likely James is thinking of Jesus. He's thinking of those Sanhedrin and all of those wealthy priests and high priests that had condemned Jesus to death. And then he says, he does not resist you. And so if the context then matters to us, then what he means here by being long-suffering and enduring or patience is in relationship to not retaliating back to those kinds of people that would abuse us and misuse us. This lesson, I think, will matter to us in the future much more than it does now. There will come a day, I am fear, that I've said to you before, that we will have to take a stand. And that stand will cost us. It will cost us dearly. And if we are going to face those days when they come to us, then we must listen to James and other passages in the Bible that teach us what kind of attitude we must have. We must not allow our mistreatment and oppression to drive us to hatred and bitterness toward the one who is doing that to us, or to direct those attitudes toward God as if God does not know and does not care about us. And I believe the context is saying to us, in light of that, of what we are to think about. He uses as the illustration farmers. And he says, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the Lord, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. Most of the time, the rains in Palestine, the early rains mean in the beginning of the year, because you would sow the crops like barley and wheat, as we do here, as we do in Panhandle, Texas. Anywhere like that, you sow them in September, October. And the rains in Palestine, the early rains came in October, November. And then the latter rains that would put the head onto the wheat and produce the seed would come in April and May. And generally speaking, that's the same way it is in Texas. It's the same way that we think about, if you were, as I said, where I grew up, they were dryland farmers. They were guys that didn't have wells punched down. And they depended on that 15 to 16 inches of annual rainfall that we got out there. I was talking with Brother Selig this morning, and he lives here, but he works in Amarillo and has for some time, and he said they got 3 inches of rain. And, you know, the rest of us might not jump up and down, but being an Amarillo guy, I know what that means, especially in the light of what it would mean to a farmer and to a farmer's son to think about your whole livelihood, your whole ability to feed your family depends upon that. It is a process for a farmer to wait. But I'm going to tell you, no matter how much he would bite his nails or fight against it or rail against God, that's not going to change how the rains come. The only thing you can do, I mean, I didn't grow up in that world. I grew up in a world where you went out and started that well motor and you watered the crop if you needed to. But those guys that have to look up to the heavens and wait. Now, you could get of the farmer the idea of watchful resignation or patience, that passiveness that I just have to sit back. But it is more the idea of dealing with our attitude toward oppression. And so we have to think about the illustration he's using in reference to that. Waiting is hard. And it is especially hard when you are suffering in the midst of it. Stressful enough upon a farmer who's waiting for it to rain, and it may not rain. But how much more stressful is it for a Christian who believes in God and Him taking care of us and knowing that the Scriptures have promised for him, for us to hope in Him and for His coming and His care for us to take care of those kinds of things. And yet Paul said to the early Christians in Acts 14:22, he said, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith and saying we must through many tribulations enter the kingdom of God. That final phase of the kingdom where it will be heaven, the rule of God, it is going to take many tribulations, Paul said, for us to enter that. Now you and I have been blessed in this world to not have to suffer those things to the degree that it has been in many places and even now is in many places on this earth. But that may not always be the case. Waiting, I said to you, is hard. I read a story about an elderly man who went to a doctor's appointment at 2 p.m. He waited for 3 hours. You ever been there? He waited for 3 hours and still nobody came and called his name. Finally, he got up. And as he was leaving, he passed by the nurse's desk, the receptionist's desk, and he said, I'm going now so I can die of natural causes. Waiting room has meaning to doctors. Waiting's not easy for any of us. It particularly is not easy if we are suffering at the hands of the oppressors. David fled from Saul, we are told. In Psalms 59, in verse 1, the heading of that psalm is about one of those times that he fled from Saul. Deliver me from my enemies, O my God, and defend me from those who rise up against me. But you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have all the nations in derision. O you, his strength, I will wait for you. For God is my defense. My merciful God shall come to meet me. God shall let me see my desire on my enemies. You think about how many times David had to flee. And it may not look like God was with him, but God was with him. And every step of the way, he managed sometimes by a hair's breadth. On one occasion, Saul has split his forces and he's coming around two sides of a mountain and David is being pinned in. And just at the critical moment, a messenger runs up to Saul and says, the Philistines have attacked. And he has to call it off and retreat. And there were all of those hairbreadth escapes that David managed, and there was that constant threat that he would be captured. One time he finally flees to Moab. You remember in studying the life of David, and yet the prophet, I believe on that occasion was Gad, came to him, or Nathan, and said, come back to Israel. Come back to Palestine. Come back to Judah. Don't stay in Moab. In the middle of the lion's mouth. But David did exactly what he said. You are my strength. I will wait for you. When David escaped to the cave of Adullam, the heading of Psalms chapter 57, verse 1, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will take my refuge until these calamities have passed by. When Doeg, the Edomite, murdered all of the priests because David had gone there, remember, taken the showbread and the sword of Goliath. In Psalms 52, the heading of that psalm is what I just talked about. Verse 7, here is the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise you forever because you have done it. And in the presence of your saints, I will wait on your name, for it is good. That is what God asks us to do and wants us to be in attitude of heart toward him. So the motivation then is, as he says in this text, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. Then the farmer illustration, verse 8, you also be patient, establish your heart, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. And that phrase is at hand may throw us, because sometimes we may think that it has to mean very shortly, and it can mean that at times. Not necessarily. In light of how you and I look at time, is not the way God looks at it. The day is a song, or as Peter said, a day in the Lord's mind, 1,000 years doesn't matter. If God promises something, the certainty of it is that it will come to pass. It is done. God is not going to go back on His word. It is hard for us when we are facing enemies, as they were in this text, to think about not depending upon God and having the wrong attitude not only toward enemies, but toward God Himself. But the motivation has to be in their heart that the Lord is at hand. We have mayflies here. Mayfly in the Greek was ephemeron. We hear our word ephemeral. Something is ephemeral. It's like a mist. It's like a ghost that appears for a short time. The mayfly's life is exactly one day. Suppose, as one man illustrated, a mayfly was over a pool of water and was capable of observing a tadpole offspring of a frog in the water below. In the mayfly's aged afternoon, by afternoon he's well into the end of his life, having seen no change in the tadpole, it would be impossible for the mayfly to conceive that the tadpole becoming a frog was very near. But you and I know how near it is. The tadpole will not stay a tadpole very, very long. But to a mayfly, it would seem like it was never going to happen. So it is in our dealing with God. The existence of Christ's calendar is not our calendar. Our ephemeral day does not negate the nearness of His coming. Now I realize His coming here may mean the destruction of Jerusalem. It may mean that sort of thing, which would have been very near to them when James wrote. But whether it is then or now, still in the light of what He is saying to us, it is but a day. God is saying to us, stay put. I'm coming. He says in verse 9, what can happen to us when we are under pressure is, do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. You might think that somehow is ripped apart, but in the context, and if you look at yours, the way the paragraph is made, it's all together. It's part of the context. So what does it mean here then? I mean, I can see about grumbling against the one who is oppressing us, but that's not what he says. He says, do not grumble or do not complain, as the New American Bible translates. Do not complain against one another. One of the negative one another passages in Scripture. You know, hostility is not an easy thing to handle, to look for someone to blame in the midst of our troubles. Maybe it would have been something like this. Your family's hit harder in that persecution than my family. And that's going to happen at times. People would be delivered, and yet other people in the congregation would suffer. And it'd be real easy to think that somehow that guy that didn't suffer had sort of sold out. Maybe had done something with the oppressors that lessened his ability. Whatever the case is, whatever our attitude, he's saying we can, in the midst of that, want to blame somebody else. And not blame, he says, your brother for that. It's one thing to get along with other believers when things are going well. It's quite another when we are under stress. I can witness that. When a family is in stress, it's even more so. And I think you understand the meaning of that. The word here, complain, means to sigh or groan inwardly, an internal feeling. Largely, it could be unexpressed. But it is that attitude by which we are harboring ill will toward someone else. But what he says to us in warning about not complaining against others, the motivation is because the real judge is standing close by. The real judge is listening to our hearts, is observing what we are doing. He's warning us always to focus our attention upon Jesus, the great judge of all men. To not just think about now. To not just think about what's going on here. John Calvin wrote of this passage, no bridle is more suited to holding back our headstrong temper than the thought that our imprecation does not go off into the air, But close at hand is the judgment of God. God is watching us. How God must be grieved to see His children fuss and fight and split and resplit, be embittered and hateful toward one another, instead of learning to get along with each other. And in the middle of such difficulties, to make it even more so. The second coming of Christ is consolation to us. It is comfort, but it is also sober warning that the judge is going to judge us in how we reacted to one another. So that we must not fuss and fight and grumble and complain and moan and groan and all the things that could go along with that in the midst of particularly of us suffering. And so he returns to this idea then of endurance in the final part of it, and it says, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. 11 times in the New Testament is the proverbial expression of suffering of the prophets. The prophets, if somebody was to think about them, would think about Jeremiah, would think about the being let down into that muddy pit in the mire and had to be dragged out of it. The times that he was threatened with life, not only from people that didn't know him, his own family plotted to kill him. Or all the other prophets that you could name in the Old Testament, what one of them ever did not suffer? Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. Matthew chapter 5, verse 12, Jesus says, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. In chapter 23, verse 37, he said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those that are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. The one that kills the prophets, the one that persecutes the prophets. Which of the prophets, Stephen asked in Acts 7:52, did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the just one of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers. James says to us in verse 10, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. You and I can think that because we are Christians, and because God is our God and has all power at His disposal, that if we speak in His name, we will not suffer. And you know that that's not so. But yet it's hard when it does happen to us. If we speak in the name of the Lord, do not expect to be exempted. In fact, expect the opposite of it. And so he says, consider them. Take them as an example of what it means to stay with it and hang in there and not give up. And then he uses, of course, Job, who is perennially the example of perseverance, the New King James translates, the endurance, the English standard. There's a word, hupomone, that means to bear up under a load, that you would carry a huge load on the back. That you're able to bear up under it. Again, it is not something that is passive. It's something that is active. Job had every human feeling toward his intense sufferings. I mean, he cursed the day of his birth. A passage that we're so prone to quote about his faith in Job 13:15 says, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. And we quote that passage about this idea of endurance, but we never quote the next part. That same verse, it's the second half of it. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. He was arguing with God. Why are you doing this to me? You have no right to do this to me. I have done nothing but follow you. And he had to be corrected. He had to learn that God is Lord of all. And if he chooses to allow us as his servants to suffer, and there is going to be reason for it. And it would happen with Job. The most fearful prayer that you can pray is, Father, do with me as you will. Do with me what I need. And help me to endure and be your servant. You have no idea what that will mean. And so he says the motivation is, here's the Lord's purpose. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. And you've heard of the steadfastness of Job and have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Notice that he does not, and again, we would be mistaken to say blessed is happy. You cannot be happy. How could Job be happy about what happened to him? And again, as I've said to you before in the past, our words happy and happen are connected. Because we think of happiness as what happens to us. But blessedness is an objective thing, not subjective. It is objective, God's approval of us. God's saying, blessed are you. No matter what the world looks at us and says, no matter what other saints look at us and say, it is an unalterable approval and reward of God. You see the end or purpose intended by God. And even though the circumstances seem unbearable by Job, what was the end for Job? God doubled his possessions. God doubled the number of his children. And even then, he did not lose the original 10. If they were faithful to the Lord, they would be restored to him in the resurrection. And Job was blessed even more. That's the end. James coins a word that's not in the Greek. He makes up a word. How the Lord is compassionate and merciful is a word that he created, basically. Has those two words in it, but he's making a word to say God will bless us if we will endure. And so trouble promotes trust in the Lord. It knocks any props out from under us to depend upon ourselves. It brings us near to him if we will let it and not further away. You don't learn to swim on dry land. You learn to swim, as guys used to do, just toss somebody in the water and say, swim or drown. And it strengthens our communion with God if we understand what it really means. I've been reading lately about Valley Forge. I know you're astounded by that. But mankind, how did we become a nation? How the Congress did not supply them. Those men who George Washington wrote himself, you could have followed their trail to Valley Forge by the blood left in the snow from their feet. No shoes, rags. Rags for clothes. They hastily built wood structures out of the logs to take care of one of the hardest winters ever. Was that winter. They went at times for a week or more without food. They boiled the leather of anything they could find. And yet they did not desert him. And they did not desert the cause. And just over in Philadelphia, not many miles away, the British were living it up big. And while they were living up big, they were hardening themselves and toughening themselves. And they drilled the German officer that came and shaped them into a real fighting force. And because of what they endured, the pain and the suffering, when they marched out in the spring and met the British army at Monmouth in that spring, it wasn't a victory, but it wasn't a defeat either. It was a stalemate. They had stood toe to toe with the British army and had not suffered like they had in the past. And they became a real fighting force. And it made all the difference. All because they went through that immense suffering. And the book I'm reading bears out the fact that not only George Washington, but how many of those men believed in God and depended upon God and called upon God. Time and time again. Again, the lesson sometimes that we learn even from our own history is that suffering has its purpose. It has a great purpose in the end. If you're subject to heaven's invitation tonight, Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned. If we can help you to become his servant, to come to him tonight, then we bid you to do so as together we stand and sing.